I walk in danger all the way. The thought shall never leave me that Satan, who has marked his prey, is plotting to deceive me. This foe with hidden snares may seize me unawares if I should fail to watch and pray. I walk in danger all the way. I pass through trials all the way with sin and ills contending. In patience I must bear each day the cross of God's own sending. When in adversity I know not where to flee, when storms of woe my soul dismay, I walk through trials all the way. And death pursues me all the way. Nowhere I rest securely. He comes by night, he comes by day. He takes his prey most surely. A failing breath and I in death's strong grasp may lie to face eternity today as death pursues me all the way. I walk with angels all the way. They shield me and befriend me. All Satan's power is held at bay when heavenly hosts attend me. They are my sure defense, all fear and sorrow hence. Unharmed by foes, do what they may, I walk with angels all the way. I walk with Jesus all the way. His guidance never fails me. Within his wounds I find a stay when Satan's power assails me. And by his footsteps led, my path I safely tread. No evil leads my soul astray. I walk with Jesus all the way. My walk is heavenward all the way. Await my soul the morrow, when God's good healing shall allay all suffering, sin, and sorrow. Then worldly pomp be gone. To heaven I now press on. For all the world I would not stay. My walk is heavenward all the way. Very nice. So we are in the Lord's Passion. He has been arrested and betrayed in the garden after having prayed. Peter is being prominently featured in these episodes. What happened at the betrayal and arrest with Peter? Anyone remember? He cut the ear off one of the guards, one of Caiaphas's guards, right? I think it was a relative of Malchus. What's the significance of Peter cutting off his ear spiritually? Faith comes, yeah.
You mentioned the ear, I was about to say it, but from what you said last week, faith comes by hearing, so cutting off the ear damages the system, but receive the word of God.
Yeah, and we would say the same thing when the church exercises the sword. Does that mean that Christian nations cannot go to war? How can you justify us as a Christian? I'm setting myself up. How can we justify us as a Christian nation ever going to war? So the Christian church has to do it. Thank you, Mike. Well, again, I served you up a knot, so I'm asking you to unravel it. I think Mike was a Boy Scout, so maybe he can notice these knots. Go ahead. Where do we get the idea that there's a separation of church and state? Does that come from our American Constitution? Is that is this one of our founding principles that the founding fathers came up with? Where do we get the idea of a separation of church and state? What weren't the Jewish nation in the Old Testament? Weren't church and state one at that time? Well, what happened?
Yes, if you render under Caesar, that's the state. And then if you run under God, what is God, that separates the certain aspects are spiritual and certain aspects are...
So you're quoting Jesus to me, which is always good. Always like it when we quote Jesus. He says, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God's the things that are God's. What is that a response? What is that an answer to? What question?
The coin.
Do we have to pay taxes? So he's saying, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. his picture is on the coin, give it back to him, right? Gary?
Yeah, in conjunction with that, it is also, as far as our government is concerned, I wasn't thinking about it, but Tony reminded me, but the Roman Empire was a government, but yet they had a duty of the Roman leaders was to be pontiff or the head organizer of all their theological and religious activities, which of course being sort of pantheistic, they had, you know, they had a lot of gods, you know, and so it's a big thing, but there was their religion, but then there was their state. And it was expected that you might be motivated by your faith, but it was the state that you served. And it's, I think, a sense that, in that sense, that's why our secular state has this future among us.
Well, that's diagnostic of what was happening back then. But what I'm asking is, why do we separate? Why do we hold it so sacred, the separation of church and state? Is it because we're Americans, or where does the idea come from? Randy. In other words, religion is none of its business. And you're saying that comes out of medieval English law. Well, we're tracing it back further. Richard?
If I recall correctly, it was shortly after the Reformation, during the Wars of the East Indies. I don't remember which one. That
Well, we're getting further back in history. Let me get you to God's Word. What does the Bible say in Romans 13? All authority is established by God, and it says that the government is God's agent of the sword. So the separation of church and state is biblical. Jesus says to render under Caesar the things that are Caesar, and Paul in Romans 13 says to be subject to the authorities, because there is no authority that is not appointed by God. But we Lutherans should be resonating with this more than anyone else, because the separation of church and state in the New Testament is the separation of law and gospel. The state is God's agent of law. When I speed, I still get traffic tickets, even though I'm a Christian. And when I break the law and get a speeding ticket, have I broken a commandment? Where does it say in the Bible that we have to keep below 70 miles an hour? It says, honor your father and your mother. My mother kept saying to stay under 72, so you're right. But the government is parental authority. It is the government that is ceded by parents to the government. We are all endowed with inalienable rights that links us to the Creator. Where does the government get its rights from? It gets it from us. So the government is the authority of the law. So if I speed, under the authority of the government, I have to pay a fine, and they report it to my insurance company, and my insurance goes up, and I got all kinds of consequences. Do I have to bring that to the church too? Or does the speeding ticket stay outside? Yeah, I bring it into the church when I confess my sins. I'm $125 poorer. Miserable, because it feels lousy to get pulled over. Sinner. Confess unto thee all my sins and iniquity. I sinned against the government. I sinned against God because he established the authority. But when I come and confess my sin in the church, by the authority of the church, do I get more fines imposed on me? Yeah, if you're a Catholic, then you get to say some Hail Marys and Our Fathers to atone for it. But as Lutherans, what do we receive when we bring that sin to the church? Mercy and forgiveness. So the separation of church and state is extremely important. And when Judy said rightly, bad people and bad nations do bad things, and we have to oppose what's bad, What does the church do? It preaches against the evil, and that's the only weapon it can use, preaching. But the state has force. And just wars means that a country, if they have justice on their side, can wage a just war, and it's not wrong, because they're opposing evil force with good force. And that's law. Okay? So where do, again, if someone asks you, where does this idea of separation of church and state come from? It's right to bring up the Reformation because it was an issue back then. Was the state and church one at Luther's day? Yeah, it was called the Holy Roman Empire and everything was under the Pope. That's why he wore two crowns, one for the secular authority and one for the spiritual authority. So it gets mucked up when they're not separated. But our government will establish no religion, separation of church and state. But where does it come from? Its roots are in Scripture. It's a Christian idea. If you want to do away with everything in the Bible, then the Muslims have it. They're going to win. For a number of reasons. All right, let's go ahead and read. And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.'" And the high priest arose and said to him, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered and said, "He is deserving of death." Then they spat in his face and beat him. And others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one who struck you." Now, the reason that I brought up church and state here at the very beginning is that this is part of the confusion and the milieu that Jesus is thrusting himself into in this place of authority that has arrested him. We have already said that it was temple guard, Roman soldiers that were attached to the temple that were being sent by Caiaphas and the high priests in order to arrest Jesus under the betrayal of Judas. So there is an odd mixture of church and state. Rome is acknowledging that the Jews wanted to be self-governing and they gave some self-governance to the Jews. When someone mentioned the great genius of the Roman Empire, they were sort of a big tent kind of operation. When they went into a region, whatever the religion was, they tried to accommodate it in any way that they could, while at the same time running their rhetoric about Caesar being the Son of God and having divine authority and being the ultimate bigwig. But he was a good politician. Big tent, he permitted these other gods, even while himself accepting and claiming for himself divine right as ruler. But there's this transition. The Jews have been self-governing, and for 400 years they have not. They went into captivity under the Persians and the Assyrians, and they became a doormat for Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire. And when Alexander the Great died and his empire was divided up into four parts, one of the generals had the Holy Land, and eventually the Romans came in and took over. So there's this milieu. I didn't write the reference here, but in Genesis 49, which of the tribes of Israel did Jacob bless and say that the scepter will never depart from this tribe? Judah, right. And do you remember what the prophecy said? The scepter shall not depart from Judah until when? I should have written the verse. I apologize. Until the man of Shiloh comes. What is a man of Shiloh? A man, Shiloh is related to Shalom. What does that mean? Peace, or hello, goodbye, but peace. So the man of Shiloh would come. And you know, the dating of Jesus' birth is kind of a dicey thing. Because there was a change in calendar, and there's not exact dates that are able to be applied. Jesus was born anywhere from about 4 BC to 4 AD. Different scholars argue about that. But they're pretty precise about when the scepter departed from Judah, because it was in Jesus' lifetime that the power of the Jews to impose the death penalty was taken away from them. And some scholars give a proof, and I don't know how valid it is, that the year that the Jews lost the ability to proclaim the death penalty and to put people to death was when Jesus reached the age of 13. Why would that be? Why would the age of 13 be relevant for a Jew? That's the cutting point where he passes from being a child to an adult. And there's something compelling about that argument that some make, that that losing of the death penalty came about that right then when Jesus reached his age of majority, his age of adulthood. There's something, it sort of ties a bow on some things for me. But I couldn't prove it because there's alternating opinions about that. But this is the case of the Jews, that they do not have the power to inflict death on anybody. But as we're going to see, they do have the ability in their ruling body, the Sanhedrin, to impose a death sentence, or to recognize that someone under Jewish law is guilty of something that should be punished by death according to their law. But they don't have the power to impose that penalty. Understand?
Kind of like California, maybe?
I was hoping that no one would bring... There's all kinds of modern analogies of political things and stuff in this text. Would you like to, if someone doesn't understand... How is this like California?
Well, they have the death penalty. I don't know if they still do, but they don't have the will and desire to carry it out. The people who are by old age on death row, rather than being executed.
I thought you were going to talk about the CAFE standards. You know about that? You know, for years, the federal government has given California permission to set their own emission standards because of the poor air in Los Angeles and their major cities. And they've recently threatened to take, because it's such an upstart state, to take away their right to do that, so they have to accept emission standards from everywhere else. And I guess the air quality in California has improved a bit since back then, too. But thanks for the reference, but especially in this next paragraph, let's not talk about false charges or anything. It never happens today, so. Isn't that a communist standard? Give me the man and I'll show you the crime. I'll find the crime. Show me the man and I'll find the crime.
Stalin.
Now we got to get back to the lesson. No more Stalin. All right. All right. Okay. Now, the chief priests. Now understand that the Jewish society has a structure. The chief priests, the elders, these are people that are in charge and recognized in authority, and all the council, and the council would be representatives of different parts of the society. There were Pharisees on the council, and there was an organization. People that were acknowledged as being part, they had representatives in this Sanhedrin and in the council. And what did they seek? They sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. What does that sentence say? They wanted him dead. They wanted a legal way in order to kill him. And they had all of the educated people, the lawmakers and the enforcers of the law, looking and plotting for legal ways to drum up charges to put him to death. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. So I've got a note there. Could someone look up for us Deuteronomy 17, verse 8? Confer.
What?
Confer.
Okay.
Anyone got it? It's Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. If anyone finds it, just read it for us. I should have brought my smartphone.
17 verse 8.
Yes.
If cases come before your courts that are too difficult for you to judge, whether bloodshed, lawsuits, or assaults, take them to the place the Lord your God will choose.
Keep going.
Go to the priests who are Levites and to the judge who is in office at the time. Inquire of them and they will give you the verdict.
That wasn't the verse I was looking for. It's in the mouth of two or three witnesses. I must have got the wrong verse. Verse 6, please read it for us.
On the testimony of two or three witnesses, a man shall be put to death, but no one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness.
Okay, that's the one. So what's it saying? You need collaboration. If a person's life is on the line, you need two or three witnesses. And why is this wise?
Because the first one might be a liar.
Anyone can say anything about anyone, and what it's saying is there needs to be two witnesses, two or three witnesses. And this two or three in Scripture is always sort of illuminating. Two or three is a good idea, which means a couple. But where there are two, there's also three. Where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. That doesn't mean we need three for a church service. We need two, because there are three that are gathered with the two. And when a witness bears witness in trial, it's not only the collaboration of his fellow citizen who is witnessing, but who also is witnessing the whole thing? God. And this used to be the powerful means in America by which we could be assured that a proper witness was going to be given. What did a person say? I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Right hand up, left hand on the Bible, right? So help me God. And what was the witness saying by that? I'm going to tell you the truth to the best of my ability with God's help, and I'm calling on God to witness with me. And if I'm lying in my witness, then I want God to stand against me. And where's God going to stand against that false witness? On Judgment Day. It's saying I'm staking my salvation on my rightly remembering and doing the best I can to tell the truth. And why is that necessary in order to get a true verdict, which means a true word at the end of the trial? Because it has to be based on the truth. A person has to be found guilty on the basis of verified truth. Otherwise, what must we assume about them? That they're innocent. That's why what verdicts are rendered in our American system? And again, the Christian thought is behind all this. Is it guilty or innocent? It's guilty or not guilty. We don't say anyone's innocent. We just say that we have not proven their guilt. So we assume that they're innocent.
I think in the UK, you're guilty until you're proven innocent. I'm serious.
Really?
You're guilty until you're proven innocent.
Well,
in the UK.
And think, see logically, that's impossible. You can't prove a negative.
They drive on the wrong side.
It's a left lane. No. Okay, so they looked for false witnesses. The false witnesses came forward, but they found none. What does that mean? They found no two that agreed, right? And this is the problem with a lie. How do you get verification of a lie? Someone has to collaborate with that. And even if you or I lie, to tell a lie is harder than telling the truth because I have to remember the lie. And it's a fabrication, so it's not as easy to remember as the truth. Okay, going on. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, "This fellow Jesus said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days." Now, hoping that I got the right reference this time, can we confer with John 2, verse 19? So Jesus is speaking here, right? And they're standing by the temple and they're looking with wonder at the stones of the temple. Isn't this magnificent? And Jesus says, verbatim of what Richard read with a correct translation, he said, destroy this temple. What is the noun of that sentence? Destroy this temple.
Temple.
No, that's the direct object. What's the subject?
You.
You destroy this temple. You destroy this temple. And if he's talking about the temple of his body, which he is he saying, I'm going to destroy myself? No, you destroy this temple. So when the witnesses agree with each other that they say, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days, it is false witness because it does not say what Jesus said, but what they wanted him to say. Were they lying or were they just misremembering? Were they saying what Jesus said or were they imposing what they wanted him to say? And was it lying or misremembering? It doesn't matter. It's the same thing. If you tell a non-truth because you're not aware of the truth, it's still a lie. And should you ever, in a court of law, give testimony to what you're not sure of?
No.
I mean, and this is a lesson for us. you may have to give testimony in court. When I was a chemist, I had to give testimony in court. And it's scary. It really is scary because you're very responsible for what you say in a court of law. So this is a lie. Now, what's the intent of this lie? What does this say about Jesus? What if Jesus actually said this, what claim would Jesus be making? I can destroy this temple. Some of you have seen the temple. Do you think you could destroy the temple? It's got stones that are 40 tons. Could you destroy that? Without dynamite? Without bulldozers? No. Quit arguing with me. We don't have time for this. He is claiming supernatural power. And he is claiming to be greater than Solomon and greater than the temple. And why would it be what we would call blasphemy to even suggest destroying the temple? What significance does the temple have?
It's a worship, a place of worship. God lives. Where God lives.
It's where God's promised to live. If you're suggesting to destroy the temple, you're destroying God's house. And this is really double entendre here, because if he's talking about the temple of his body, that is where God dwells. That's the dwelling place of God. And is he going to destroy it? No, they're going to destroy it. And the high priest arose and said to him, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" In other words, don't you have a response to this? Aren't you going to defend yourself to these charges? But Jesus kept silent. Why did Jesus keep silent? Isaiah 53, like a lamb to the slaughter, he opened not his mouth. It's in prophecy. And the high priest answered, which means responded to him, and said, "I put you under oath by the living God." In other words, he's invoking a necessity to the living God. Does he have the authority to invoke such an oath? Yeah. Just as the government can invoke you to take an oath when you give testimony. And they can subpoena you and insist on your testimony. He has the authority to do it. "Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And that's the big question. Jesus said to him, "You said it. You said it, brother." He's not opening his mouth. He's using the testimony used against him. "You said it." "Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Now, I get these references all wrong anyway. Can anyone guess what happens in Acts 9, verse 3? Well, that's Acts 7. But it happens after that. Remember, St. Paul or Saul is standing watching in Acts 7 as Stephen is being stoned and put to death and going up into heaven. And it's in chapter 9 that he's on the road to Damascus. And the point that I have here is that, what is Saul? He's a Pharisee. And there are Pharisees on the council. I wonder if Saul maybe even was on the council. He said he was a prominent Pharisee. Who knows? But Saul is aware of Jesus saying this. And what does he say? "Hereafter," in other words, from now on, the next time you see me, you're going to see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power. Well, what does Saul see on the road to Damascus? Jesus in the clouds at the right hand of God. And I believe that this is what drove Saul to the ground, because Jesus said that and he knew it. Do you think Saul ever set eyes on Jesus before Jesus was crucified? I 99.9%. And he sees him in the clouds, and he remembers the word of Jesus, whether he was there or not. He was a stricken sinner. God bless him. God bless, may we be stricken as Saul was with the guilt of our sin. Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy." Now, is the high priest right? Has Jesus spoken blasphemy? If he is not the Son of Man, described in Daniel and Ezekiel in the Old Testament, if he's not the Messiah, he is speaking blasphemy, claiming to be the Son of God if he is not. But the whole thing hinges on the fact that he is. And the Son of God here is seen as the greatest of sinners among his people because he speaks the truth to them. And in this we see how the Jews become a Gentile nation. Their God has come and delivered everything he promised in the Old Testament. And they see the fulfillment of God's promises in Jesus as pure blasphemy. Not from the God, but from devil, and as mockery of God. That which must offend God. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, we have all the witnesses we need. You all heard his blasphemy. He said it publicly. And he deserves to die. Anyone got Leviticus 24, verse 16, knock on wood? Richard. Now, who gives that law? The blasphemer should be put to death by stoning. Who gives that law? God. This is the law of God. Blasphemy deserves death. And that's what they should impose on blasphemers. So, under the word of God, and in this false witness and this false perception of Jesus, they answered and said, "He is deserving of death." Then they spat in his face and beat him. His suffering is beginning and being continued. Others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one who struck you?" And so he begins. He's under the condemnation of the Jewish leaders, and he awaits, therefore, the persecution and treatment under the Roman authorities. Why? Again, because the Jews do not have the authority to impose the death penalty. And so they must work with the Gentiles, with the Romans, in order to do it. God's peace go with you. Pastor Wolf.
So this is a perfect example of prejudice, right? They asked him, charged him to tell the truth by God, and he did. They had already judged him guilty. And so they condemned him even though he was done.
And this is what prejudice is. It's good to say what it is. It is prejudging without any facts. It's prejudging with absolutely no evidence. And no one deserves to be prejudiced. And everyone deserves to be prejudiced in a way. We're all sinners. But as we act with one another, we should act by what we see and know. And prejudice is out of bounds for anybody. Good. Thank you.